Hey out there, and welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo, and with me as always are my trusty partners in science, Barbara and Aubrey.
Before we begin the discussion today, remember that you can tweet, message, poke, or tag us on our Twitter or Facebook page. Follow along with us at ISGP Forum with the hashtag ISGP Forum, or look us up on Facebook using ISGP's The Forum. The Institute on Science for Global Policy loves to hear everyone's input, so don't be shy.
Today we'll be socializing over the at times highly sensitive hot-button subject of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, which have been known to boil some blood and agitate some tempers over almost every form of media you can imagine. But today, right here on the forum, we're going to change all that.
That's right! Today we're going to give you the skinny on a debate from the conference Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Focus on Food and the Environment. This ISGP Signature Series meeting took place in partnership with Cornell University during October 5th through 8th in 2014 in Ithaca, New York. So, during this discussion on genetic modification, we're going to keep cool, calm, and collected.
And a little goofy.
Mainly because we can't help that part of it.
Definitely not.
We will stress our calmness and collectedness as we lay down some fascinating proposals for feeding the world, all while attempting not to stir up the makings of World War III, Battle of the Foodies.
Well, I guess we should start by formally introducing today's paper and presenter.
Good idea. As it turns out, this debate holds a very special place in my heart because it's the first ISGP debate that I ever moderated.
That was like throwing you to the wolves, having the rookie moderator handle a debate on a very testy subject like GMOs.
True that. Well, you can find this and other papers at scienceforglobalpolicy.org under the Publications tab. Today's paper is titled Adopting Genetically Modified Crops Worldwide for Food Security, and was written by Dr. Jennifer Ann Thompson, an emeritus professor in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology at the University of Cape Town.
That's right. We got someone to fly all the way from South Africa to talk to us about this subject, so you know it's important.
If not hugely important to the discussion of food security, a basic understanding of GMOs is important for any consumer who wants to better understand what they're eating and how their favorite foods might take a slightly different form in the future.
Wait. Let's back it up here. We need some definitions and clarifications.
Right you are. Okay, so GM technologies, GM foods, GMOs, all those GM terms you hear, they can be pretty confusing for the average non-biologist out there. These terms get tossed around quite often and with little explanation, so it's no wonder a lot of people are skeptical or confused.
For the purpose of this conversation, when we say GM, we're referring to a genetic modification or the characteristics of being genetically modified. This means bypassing traditional breeding methods and altering an organism by manually changing around some of its genetic properties. For instance, you might think of a specific gene being deleted or introduced.
One of the most widely known and successful examples of this process is the creation of golden rice, which is simply rice genetically enriched with vitamin A. This rice gets its famous name from its yellow color, which is due to the beta-carotene it contains. This beta-carotene, also naturally found in carrots and various other foods, turns into vitamin A when it's digested.
This little alteration and increase in vitamin A may seem simple or superfluous, but it's estimated that in 2010, some 1.9 to 2.8 million people, mainly women and children, died from vitamin A deficiency. This is a real problem in less affluent countries. And many people see food alteration as a real solution.
Exactly. There is no doubt that the implementation of genetic modification is a hugely controversial topic. But our debaters believe that many people in less affluent countries, like portions of Africa or Asia, for instance, will soon need to rely on GM crops to supply micronutrients, such as vitamin A, in order to round out their diets.
In fact, some countries already do.
And with the threat of climate change on the horizon, these food insecurities will only be intensified because many now fertile lands could become arid or inundated with plant disease.
If a deadly pathogen arrives to wipe out an entire crop of papaya or banana, many people could become food insecure if there's no alternative pathogen-resistant crop. By the way, food insecure means that a normal expected supply of food is lacking. Anyway, GM technologies have the potential to make a pathogen-resistant crop, which could be life-saving for those who have no other options.
Living in affluent nations, such as the U.S. or much of Europe, makes it difficult to truly see the effects of widespread food insecurity because, well, many of us don't exactly deal with this problem. There are about 4 different stores within 5 miles of my house where I know I can purchase food 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Cleo, I don't think Taco Bell or gas station candy counts as real food.
That's besides the point. And for the record, midnight runs for chocolate are vital to mental health. Need I bring up last September in Raleigh, the Institute on Science for Global Policy's SciComm conference, our spontaneous trip to the 24-hour Walmart when the 3 of us were desperate for ice cream?
When the idea for this podcast happened to be developed?
Point taken.
What I mean by this, though, is that I, along with the vast majority of Americans, am not living in fear of constant starvation. While our food transportation system has its own set of issues, it does in fact exist and function pretty darn well.
And we can't exactly say the same for many less affluent nations, which struggle daily with obtaining food items from their own inefficient transportation systems.
Why, again, does transportation have so much to do with implementing GM crops? You lost me at Taco Bell.
We're getting there.
Well, as you know, not all regions are capable of growing food at all times of the year. So it's vital to be able to transfer food from one region to another to ensure that everyone gets fed. This act of transporting becomes rather difficult, though, when you run into issues like limited access to electricity, political unrest, or government corruption.
Not to mention the fact that the demand for food will only increase with our ever-expanding population.
So what the debaters are saying is that with GM crops, these less affluent regions could potentially grow more of their own food, creating a self-sufficient food supply, and be less reliant on sketchy transportation?
That's the idea, and not only could these crops be more abundant, but more nutritious too, such as the golden rice scenario. Regions wouldn't have to sacrifice the cultural importance of their food, as GM technologies could increase the nutritional value of foods that are already native to traditional cultures, but may not traditionally supply critical vitamins and such.
The debaters and Dr. Thompson also agree that the implementation of pest-resistant crops could significantly reduce the use of pesticides worldwide. Pesticides, mind you, that can be incredibly harmful to both humans and the environment.
How do we know these GM crops aren't just as harmful, though? I think that's the biggest concern on the minds of most skeptics.
Scientists have, in fact, performed some long-term studies, some over 20 years long, on the human health and environmental effects of GM technologies. These tests have thus far come back clean.
Okay, but humans tend to live longer than 20 years. What happens after that?
You've got me there. The debaters were stumped, too. They suggested that additional research on the long-term effects of GM products on humans is needed in order to address public concerns.
But the debaters did point out that perhaps it's better to try this new technique, which has the potential to be compatible with humans and the environment, as opposed to our current practice of using pesticides, a practice that we know for a fact immediately and significantly harms all parties involved.
This train of thought led the debaters to generally agree that GM crops are not only useful, but a necessary component in the establishment of food security worldwide. And let me tell you, this consensus was miraculous. I mean, given that within the first 5 minutes of the debate, there were about 20 name tags waving in my face, indicating that 20 debaters were indignant about the GM topic at hand.
All right, so we get that GM crops have a lot of potential for feeding people, and that they are already being used in some places. So what's the holdup? You know, besides the widespread public outcry against their use?
Well, you definitely nailed a lot of it down right there. GMOs have become so controversial through the past few years that they're a taboo subject in some conversations. And they've even been known to tear apart some of the strongest, most steadfast relationships.
Wait, really? Okay, so that part might not be true, but only because we don't have empirical evidence for support.
But please, if you've lived any awkward GM-related moments, or have had a food conversation cause a family divide over Thanksgiving dinner, do tell on our Facebook page.
Or on Twitter. Either will suffice. We'll create a mini-series, How GMOs Destroyed My Marriage.
Okay. So GM foods are controversial. But what isn't controversial these days?
Well, this controversy, which is often only perpetuated by the spread of misinformation by the media, has people focusing on GM crops as unnatural things that are therefore unsafe to eat.
And in at least one respect, this confusion is understandable. For one thing, scientists have a pretty bad track record for communicating these new technologies to the public. People aren't well informed, and they're consequently scared when they hear their food is suddenly going to do something it naturally would never do, such as repel insects.
Ironically, it turns out that this food enhancement, think Peter Parker as he transforms from ordinary human to Spider-Man, has already been going on for quite some time. And you might not have even known about it. How, you may ask? Well, through the process of intensive breeding, and with the help of scientists, plants can be grown in ways that allow them to express certain desirable characteristics. These qualities can range from appearance, to durability, to nutritional qualities.
The main difference is that intensive breeding takes a longer amount of time to achieve the same end results as genetic modification.
Okay. So suppose you can assure the average consumer that the food that they already eat actually has a long history of alteration. The next issue to tackle is this. What can be said about GM crops' relationship with huge ag companies like Mosaic and Monsanto?
Yeah, GM crops often exist and proliferate within the sphere of large corporate farms. It turns out, though, that this tends to be the case because of the exorbitantly expensive regulation standards of genetic modification. As they stand, only the big companies can financially afford to develop and utilize these crops.
And for the smaller companies who do want to use this technology, it takes some work. Doing so usually involves relying on government support, or partnering with one of the multinational corporations that are often viewed by the public and some agriculturalists as a threat to small farmers.
Couldn't the government help out a bit more?
In theory, yes. But the debaters observed an extreme lack of political will when it comes to GM technology because of a highly skeptical public. And naturally, this lack of public and political backing only causes consumers to become even more skeptical.
A vicious and wholly unproductive cycle.
Some might say we've gotten ourselves into quite the pickle.
But is the pickle genetically modified?
Yes, but I'm not sure if it's locally sourced.
Okay, cool it, you two, with the hypothetical pickle. We really need to be talking about the fact that although these GM pest-resistant crops seem pretty awesome now, they're not 100% successful on all pests. And some pesticides still need to be used. What's more, the pests are eventually going to adapt to overcome these resistant plants, just like they do now with sprays.
Just like microbes eventually adapt to antibiotics. Shout out to episode 2 of the forum, titled Resisting Resistance. But in all seriousness, the fact that pests will overcome the plants' genetically introduced resistance? Well, that's a downer.
Tell me about it. Because of these holdups and drawbacks, the debaters were fairly unsure whether it would be beneficial to invest in these GM practices as opposed to lower-tech solutions.
So all this research and time spent on GM technology could essentially be for nothing? Let's get into some of the solutions our debaters discussed so that maybe we can save the morale of this conversation.
Good call. Well, first things first. Education! I know this idea gets tacked on for every environmental issue we face, but it is such a vital part of the GMO equation.
People right now are so unsure of what to believe or are basing their opinions on misleading and falsified information. This simply has to stop.
The historic lack of communication and transparency about GMOs among agricultural industries, research institutions, and consumers has created an environment of distrust for agricultural biotechnologies as a whole. On the bright side, the debaters didn't think this distrust was irreversible.
By increasing transparency and improving accountability through open communication with stakeholders, we could start including everyone in the conversation of food security.
How exactly are we planning to improve this communication?
Well, illustrating caution and testing messages on smaller audiences before they're widely dispersed could save a lot of headaches. Proactively taking steps to avoid saturating these messages with research and instead tapping into value systems that hold true to the public is also important.
But are people really going to trust information coming from the sources that they feel are dishonest and have already betrayed them?
Chances are, no. So our debaters decided that if this were the case, then a trustworthy source of information about GM technologies must be identified and used to engage the public. This is not a cure-all, though. Developing consumer trust is no doubt going to require consistent, responsible actions, transparent communication, and, to put it simply, time.
Our debaters astutely pointed out some other things that could be of assistance, like enlisting the help of multinational corporations.
Those tend to have a lot of money, don't they?
Exactly, and they can use this money to support the development of GM crops that address significant climate-related issues, like the creation of drought-resistant strains of rice and other staples.
This all sounds good to me, but I have a quick question. Are we getting on track to replace all of our crops with analogs altered by GM technologies?
Not quite, and the debaters did discuss this detail. At the debate table, at least, it seemed that there was a divide between using these technologies and crops all the time, as well as prior to disasters that threaten food security, or utilizing this technology only when absolutely needed, like a worst-case scenario solution.
Well then, we've given you listeners out there a lot to think about today, and now it's your turn to weigh in. If you were at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's debate table, how would you respond to the issues we've summarized today?
How can we best educate people on this highly polarized topic? Is it realistic to task the agricultural industry with convincing the public and other stakeholders that it can be transparent regarding the issue at hand?
Would you feel comfortable eating a plant that repels insects? How does your answer change when said plant's health impacts have been studied for 20 years? 50 years? What about 100 years?
Finally, what specifically can scientists do to make you, the consumer, feel like your food is safe? Then again, is any of this relevant if there are starving people who need food immediately?
Whatever your question, comment, or answer, let us know by tweeting us at ISGPForum with the hashtag ISGPForum.
Or, of course, write us on our Facebook page, ISGP's The Forum.
Thanks so much for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.